on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to begin today with this month's installment of the Accountability Index, our series with reporters from the Baltimore Brew, in which we examine issues of fiscal and policy accountability in state and local government. Last month, we talked about construction delays and budget overages on some local road projects. This morning, Mark Reuter from the Baltimore Brew joins me to talk about the city's audit process. Good morning, Mark. Good to see you.
Well, it's good to be here.
So you've written a series of stories. You've been on this for a long time about audits, both for the city as a whole and for individual agencies. There was a law passed by referendum back in 2012, Council Bill 12-0053, requiring an audit of each agency every 4 years. That's what you've been following up on.
Right. And over three years have passed, and there have been repeated promises by the administration that audits would be coming out. The first plan was to have 5 agency audits out last June. Then that was delayed to September, and the number of audits reduced to 3 agencies. That was delayed again to November. Promises were made that there would be 3 agency audits consisting of both financial and performance audits last Monday. And lo and behold, there has been 1 performance audit of 1 agency that has not yet been publicly released. It should be released this morning.
This is the Department of Transportation.
Correct.
An outside audit firm did it, Hamilton Enterprises. You wrote a year ago that there was some disagreement about whether it should be an outside auditor or the internal, you know, audit agency of the city government. Be that as it may, these folks found an awful lot of things that they couldn't really deliver an opinion on.
Right.
And there's no financial audit of the Department of Transportation.
That's what's really kind of amazing is the promise financial audit, which is what most taxpayers and citizens would like to see, how the numbers work out, has been delayed again with no word on when it will come out. Our sources tell us maybe February, but given the history I just mentioned, I wouldn't be waiting with bated breath. What did come out was a 40-page performance audit. And that's interesting to taxpayers and citizens. They looked in 5 key areas of Department of Transportation in areas that they said they accomplished certain things, that the amount of streetlights that were lit, the amount of roads that were repaved. And what they found is in all 5 cases, there was no supporting documentation for these numbers. And taking it back to Department of Transportation, except in a couple little spots of quibbling, they all agreed. And their point was, oh, we're going to start doing that now.
In the executive summary of this audit, which I'm holding in my dirty little paws here, it says that the department, this is the opinion of the auditor, the department did not demonstrate a system of accountability and oversight for the estimating, measuring, or reporting of performance measures, which means that they don't really have any system in place to monitor what they're doing.
Right. But what they also found in one case, which I think is a good one, is the city has what the mayor is very proud of called outcome budgeting, and where the budgeting is supposed to be set up for target accomplishments. And in Department of Transportation, one of these was the amount of streetlights that are actually lit at night based on complaints and other ones of inspected streets. Well, the city has been saying over the last few years that the first year, 80% were hunky-dory, were all lit. And then the following year, it went up to 85. And the most recent year, 90. They couldn't find, again, anything to support this.
Right. The audit firm could not find anything
right.
to support this.
They then looked at 311 calls and looked at other data in city government where people were complaining about my street light. And they estimate that around 65% was the actual number. So a difference between 90, that looks very good on paper, and 65 that they think is accurate. And DOT did not protest, did not say that was wrong.
Right. And the auditor even said that it's just, it seems like they were tacking on 5% improvement every year, somewhat arbitrarily. This is a 40-page report that's going to be released today. As you say, it's just about performance, not about finances. Mm-hmm. But even the performance stuff is somewhat questionable, given that they had so little information to work with. This is no small agency. It's also amazing. DOT is the 3rd largest agency in the city government, just behind police and public works.
Mm-hmm.
There's a city budget, but there has not been audits done. There have not been audits done of these individual agencies to see how they're either performing or spending the money that's allocated.
Right. No one knows in city government. Maybe 25 years, maybe 35 years, maybe never. And it was just something they didn't do. And what's apparent is that the present administration is not interested on its watch to have this happen because they have resisted and delayed this process over and over again. I mean, after all, it's been 3 years since the voters mandated this, and one half of one of the 13 agency audits has now been performed.
You're finding, basically, as you cover this over these many, many months, that there's just a pattern of resistance to having it done, having it released, and having this information known. How is the city council supposed to oversee the fiscal doings of the city when they don't have information about how each of these departments are actually functioning?
That's very true. But there's really only two councilmen out of the 14 that have been vocal in saying that not knowing how money is spent is poor practice. The key one is Carl Stokes.
He's running for mayor.
This, yeah. Who is also running for mayor, largely on the platform of audits. And then the newcomer, who actually was a federal government auditor, is Eric Costello, and he has brought this by. They have had repeated hearings with the administration and where the administration finance directors assures them of dates that are certain, that are anticipated, that he's sure will happen. And in June, again in September, and again last week, that didn't happen.
There is also, as we finish up real quickly here, there seems to be some tension, some great amount of tension between Joan Pratt, the city comptroller, and Mr. Raymond, the director of the Department of Finance. There's this tension between the financial people and Pratt, who oversees the audit department.
Right.
If there is an audit department in the city of Baltimore, what have they been doing for the last 35 years?
It's pretty amazing. It is a huge department with many millions of dollars. I think there's dozens and dozens of auditors. Well, they do such things as they audit the Enoch Pratt, they audit the city golf courses, and they audit a number of things that are very, very peripheral. Part of that is the mandate that was set up, but they've been very unaggressive, and the controller, who has been controller of Baltimore for the last 25 years, has just been very unaggressive, to couch it most generously, in looking to see whether taxpayer money is actually spent as it said it's being spent.
All right, more on this as we continue our series, The Accountability Index. Mark Roeder, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Roeder is a reporter at the Baltimore Brew, a daily news website featuring investigative reporting and informed commentary about Baltimore and the region. He's been reporting in this area since 1970 as a longtime reporter with the Baltimore Sun and now for the Baltimore Brew. This is the second installment of our series, The Accountability Index, and we look forward to more conversations in which we are basically asking, who's minding the store when it comes to public dollars and public policies? We've got more information and a link to the Brew on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
My guest now is the acclaimed actor and writer Anna Deavere Smith. In addition to her work in television on shows like The West Wing, Madam Secretary, and Nurse Jackie, she has made 18 documentary dramas in which she plays a myriad of characters through whom we are guided with trenchant insight around the complexities of different social issues. She's taken on subjects like the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, integration, and the U.S. healthcare system. Last weekend, I went to Center Stage to see one of two performances of her latest play called Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education. It is a masterpiece of storytelling and a provocative call to action to end what is often called the school-to-prison pipeline. Anna Deavere Smith and I spoke on Monday. Welcome to the program.
Great to see you.
It was terrific to be in the audience. A real honor to be in the audience on Sunday and see this work. It's just incredible. For folks who aren't familiar with your process and with your work and how you put these together, tell them how you approach it and how you execute it.
Well, I interview people. lots of different kinds of people about an issue, usually a controversial issue or something like this, catastrophe, you know, what's happening to our young people and how so many of them don't make it through school and end up in the criminal justice system. And then after I've acquired all of these interviews, I pick certain parts of the interviews and I play a lot of the parts in the course of an evening. I'm not sure how many in this play. Maybe it's around 18 people.
I counted 18.
It's 18 people. Yeah. And Baltimore has just been a very important part of the project.
Yeah, you are of Baltimore.
I'm from
and
here.
And you are also of teaching.
Yes, I've been teaching for 40 years.
Yeah.
But more importantly than that, because I teach artists in very and have been teaching artists in very elite institutions for a long time. I currently am a professor at NYU. I taught at Stanford for 10 years and so forth. But my mother was a public school teacher here. Her friends were all public school teachers. All my aunts were public school teachers in this city. And it was really palpable to me that teachers were able to change lives.
Yeah. But, of course, you approach this not just from the education perspective. There's actually, in a way, not a whole lot about education in particular in this work. This is, you talk about the holistic experience of these young people who are growing up in poverty, who are growing up with so many cards in the deck stacked against them.
Well, right. As one of the characters who's Judge Anders from Philadelphia says, he doesn't really see it as over-policing of the schools. He sees it more as a path way in the drug industry because kids don't have very much money. By 14, they're out there selling drugs. So, I also, the deeper I looked into this, and, you know, I've talked to everything from judges to the kids themselves to a famous neuroendocrinologist, you know. So you could talk about trauma. You could talk about health. You can talk about the criminal justice system. You could talk about drugs. You can talk about guns. There's a whole lot you can talk about here. And in fact, the deeper I get into it, the more concerned I get actually by calling it the school-to-prison pipeline, because I think it blames teachers and schools for something which is a much bigger problem, as you say. Poverty has really got a hold on our country, I think, in ways that it I don't know that it's had before.
Yeah. I guess in the program note, you mentioned that you spoke to about 50 people locally.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, you know, another 100 or so from other parts of the country. How did you make the choices about who to include in the finished work
I did a lot of research in Northern California up on an Indian reservation, the Yurok tribe in Stockton, which is a bankrupt city, big homicide-ridden city, Philly. I'll be going to South Carolina in January to finish up the work. Well, with all of my work, my grandfather, who was a Baltimore businessman, had a shop for many years on Pennsylvania Avenue, Smith's Teas and Coffees, had an eighth grade education, which I hear actually for a black man in his time was, you know, started a business with a basket of tea. And put all his kids through college. You know, he said to me when we were little, he said, if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. If you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And that has become what I've been doing. I mean, you know, I'm on TV, thank God, sometimes. But really, how I spent my life is going around America, you know, trying to become America word for word by repeating the words of Americans. And in many ways, you could say it's to, you know, get rid of the crisis in my own life, which was growing up in a de facto segregated town and not really feeling, being told I wasn't
here,
really
Baltimore,
Maryland, being told somehow I wasn't really a true American, only to find out when Skip Gates did my roots on his show, Finding Your Roots, that, you know, one of my great uncles buried all the dead in Gettysburg. We were free since this 18th century, all these things. But there is a way that you are made to feel you don't belong. And I think that belongingness, that was one thing then, but I think it's something different now that's even worse.
And your road into these characters is their language.
Their language. What they say.
Even when they stutter, when they...
Well, I think of it as utterances. You know, Grandpa, said if you say a word often enough, but I would say it's if you say an utterance often enough. So it's every sound that comes out of their mouth.
Yeah. And what do you think we get from hearing you do these voices as opposed to, you know, you could have done a video montage of all of these different people speaking, saying exactly the same thing you were saying, because these are verbatim transcripts of your interviews with these people from all over the map. What do we understand because we're hearing you imitate them or act them, portray them?
I'm not sure. And you, as a person who knows music, I hope your audience knows that you know music. You know, that would be kind of like saying, well, so why have Renee Fleming sing something and have Jesse Norman sing something? I mean, why and Tom Waits sing the same song? You know, why not just listen to the same thing that was recorded in 1910. Mm-hmm. To me, it's exactly kind of like that you expect the singer to bring a new illumination to that thing and bring it alive, by the way, very significantly in the present. So even though there are films of my work,
live,
I think it's different live to bring it alive to you, present, I think is something about that.
The actor and writer Anna Deavere Smith, her latest project is called Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education on 88.1. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Some of these characters are just, all of them are so powerful in their own way. There's one in particular, Judge Anders, whom you just alluded to, who showed showed you a little a picture of a little kid, like an 8-year-old kid, and then a picture of that same kid as he had grown up to be a 20-year-old man. Tell us about that experience.
I got to say that if people would leave the theater last night and feel discouraged, you shouldn't, because I am meeting extraordinary people from all different walks of life. And Judge Anders, when we came to that meeting, had gone through his files to find this to show us of a young man who just grew up in the system. And what the judge's point is just imagine how many judges this young man saw from the age of 4 or 5 to the age of 20. His mother was a drug addict, so he grew up. How many judges would he have been in front of, even when he wasn't doing anything wrong, right? And that nobody stopped it. Nobody intervened. And he talks about how judges play a very important role, not only in protecting the public, but treating people with the dignity they deserve. And so when you think of it, there's so many ways. And he says that when he sentenced this guy, he said, "We failed you. The system failed you. We did not provide you with an education, a safe environment, many of the things that we are supposed to do." So we think of all the ways, which is why we should be careful about blaming schools, all the ways these kids just fall through the system, whether it's because they get at 19 years old, as one character says, they're at a 1.7 reading level, that no teacher in no school, no environment in all of those years was able to teach them how to read. Or, I mean, then I suppose if we get to health matters, it would be the same. So
Sure. That's
the judge is really telling us that there are many opportunities to stop that pipeline, and many of us are not doing our simple part to do it.
Back in June, as part of this process, you were here in Baltimore and you were conducting these interviews and you were talking to folks, and you did a public presentation with our mutual friend Taylor Branch.
And also another one with Sherrilyn Ifill.
Right, who was part of this production, as a matter of fact. Taylor Branch, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. You talked to Taylor about the paucity of empathy. And it seems to me, as I left the theater, it was pretty depressing. But the key to this is empathy between communities who don't often know each other, white communities who don't understand what it's like to grow up in Sandtown, Winchester, or Oliver, or Rosemont, who don't have no notion of what it's like to walk to school past boarded up houses and people slinging dope on the street, etc. How do we create empathy from enough people outside of these communities to have the political will to make the investment in those
communities? Part of it is a logistical problem and part of it is a spiritual problem, right? The logistical problem is that we have very few places where we can convene. And it's really easy for us to live in what I call safe houses of identity, right? Like I could, if I wanted to, as an artist, I could be concerned only with matters of African-American women, let's say. Mm-hmm. That's what I could do. That's not what I did. I decided to go where I didn't belong and chase that which was not me. And I'm constantly trying to invite my students to think about coming out of this safe house of identity, which they're getting more and more particular now, if you notice. You know, and people say it's because of, you know, all these different news stations, but it's also because people really want to be in their affinity group. We have to find those people, and I think that's what leadership is, who are willing to walk back and forth between communities and take people with them to say, I need you to see this. I need you to do this over there. And by the way, it needs to go both ways. So if the rich go towards the poor also should be invited to go towards the rich, you know. So we cannot afford to stay in our little places, whether it's out of a feeling of self-righteousness or whether it's out of racism, you know, and that prevails always.
You took us on quite a ride in all sorts of places on Sunday, and I look forward to seeing how this work continues to develop. It was an honor to be there and an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you.
The actor and writer Anna Deavere Smith, her latest one-person play is called Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education. Come to the Maryland Morning website. We'll have links to conversations on Twitter and Facebook about the Anna Deavere Smith Pipeline Project and some suggestions as to how you can get involved with schools and advocacy groups that are working on issues related to education, incarceration, and job training. The address is wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Also, this weekend, there is a very cool new project being unveiled at Center Stage. It's a project called My America 2, and it asks the question, what is the new civil rights movement? Kwame Kwe Arma, the Center Stage's artistic director, produced 6 videos at 6 of the sites in which young black men were killed, places like Sanford, Florida, Cleveland, Ohio, Staten Island, New York, and of course here in Baltimore. They're screening some of these films and performing others live on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. We've got more information, again, wipr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
The Everyman Theater in Baltimore's Bromo Tower Arts and Entertainment District opens their latest show tonight. Outside Mullingar is by the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright John Patrick Shanley. You probably know his work. He wrote Doubt. He wrote Moonstruck. Outside Mullingar is a love story set in Ireland, and to prepare this production, director Donald Hicken called on the expertise of the Everyman's resident dialects coach to help the American actors sound Irish. He is Gary Logan, and he joins me this morning here in Studio A. Good morning. It's good to meet you. So Outside Mullingar has an interesting challenge, as I understand it, because it's not just an Irish accent, but it's an accent particular to this particular region of Ireland. Do I have that right?
Yes, that could be said of every single dialect, that dialect or idiolect is specific to that particular place. And it has Irishisms. But they're not the sounds that you'd find in places like Belfast or Donegal or Galway. It's different.
Uh-huh. So let's use Nathan and I as guinea pigs,
all right,
and learn how to sound
You're
Irish.
You're making me a guinea pig, too?
That's right. You know, okay. I'm sorry. I'm not going down alone here, Nathan. You're on the ship, baby. You're coming down with me. So you brought in a piece of the script from the play.
Mm-hmm.
It involves two characters, Rosemary and Anthony, and there's a line that you're going to help us learn to say with the proper dialect. The line is, "The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been."
Right.
So this is something both Nathan and I could probably say, you know, quite credibly, you know,
okay,
accent or not, because
I could say it without accent.
Well, I'd start with the actors this way. I would take them to a particular place in the mouth. So we have, as Americans, kind of an open-throated sound, the way that I'm doing right now. But in this dialect, we want to push everything forward so that you're not using the back of the mouth, you're not opening up the pharynx or anything like that. You're talking in the forward placement of the mouth towards the lips and the teeth. So first of all, that's where we have to start from in terms of where we start the placement of the voice. That's one thing. Then the second
thing. Like the placement of the voice, forward rather than back.
That's right.
Got it.
Then the second two features that we'll talk about today, because there are a million, but there are two important ones in this line, and that is that when we meet a T, the T kind of leaks. It's like a leak from a tire. So it's not just t-t-t, it's t-t-t, has a splash, has a little bit of air behind it. So I would say not, not, not. Will you try that, you guys?
All right,
not.
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 Oh, a lot not. More leakage. Not.
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 Right, right.
Not.
Right, okay, right.
I have to clean right. off the microphone after that. Not.
That's right. That's right. There's a little bit of spill there. Then the other thing is in the word theirs. The TH, whether it's voiced or unvoiced, has a particular placement. So if we're gonna do the D, the TH kind of turns into sort of a D. When you make a D, you're using the tip of the tongue, the apical portion of the tongue, along what's called the alveolar ridge. You know that
the back of your upper teeth, right?
Upper teeth, but a little bit behind, where it's sort of a slipping shelf up to the dome of the. That's where T T's and D's are made. So if you would just try this and just go da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Great.
Da, da, da,
da. Great. Now, in dialects, we can make D's anywhere we want. If I ask you to make a D in the very highest portion of the dome of the hard palate, would you do that? Would you go da 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 da?
Da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Right. And then we all of a sudden are going subcontinental, kind of where India, right? When we go da da da. Now, if we're going to make that D against the back of the upper incisors, almost in between the teeth. So
like
we're
da, 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 da.
Right. So
there's a little more leakage there too.
Yeah, and we say theirs. Would you say theirs?
Theirs.
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 Yeah, that's right. That's yeah. right. That's the feeling. So you're using the back teeth as the backboard. The other thing is the music of a dialect. There are different places in Ireland that do different things with the musicality of a line. So for instance, in Donegal, they might take something and swing it up at the end like that. They'll
swing
take a
it
line
up at the end,
right? But that isn't Westmeath where we are. So we're going to be kind of tumbling down the hill a little bit with the music of the voice. So it's the problem is. Let's try that. The problem is.
The problem is.
That's pretty good.
The problem is.
That's very good. Yeah. The problem is. There's just not enough.
There's just not enough.
That's good.
There's, don't mind, do it for me again. I'm sorry, I lost.
There's just not enough.
There's just not enough.
Very good.
Sounds like Ringo Starr to me. saying, Nathan.
You know,
sounds great, but it sounds like Ringo Starr.
It's funny you say that, because if you look at a map, even though there's water in between them, they're not far away. Uh-huh. And the Liverpudlian dialect has what's called Scouse, which is an Irish influence.
All right, so there's just not enough.
Yeah, there's just not enough air.
Air.
Air, good. In the world.
In the world.
In the world.
In the world. A little bit harder on the R.
In the world.
Yeah, that's you're getting there. That's good. That's right. Air in the world to suit me.
Air in the world to suit me.
To suit me?
That was good pickup on that, Nathan, because what you did was sort of a semi-liquid U after the S, which is great, but not an over-rounding of the lips. This is how I'd work with the actors, because we're not trying to over-round lips. That's why we have words like do and to and you, rather than do and to and you. Yeah. Great. So the world to suit me, and there never has been.
And there never has been.
And there never has been.
Right. So let's try the line. The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
All right. So, Nathan, I'll go first. The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
Great start.
Would you give me another one to mock
yeah.
it off of?
The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
The problem is there's not...
Not enough?
Not enough.
Yeah, it's a spillage from not into enough, not enough.
Not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
Right.
Fantastic. You're good at this, Turner. You're very good. All right, and unfortunately, there's not enough time in the segment
not
to
enough.
Keep going.
Never enough time.
So, Gary Logan, thank you so much. Great to see you, and we look forward to the show at Everyman.
Thank
Gary
you.
Gary Logan, how would you say... Please support your public radio in the appropriate accent.
In a Mullingar accent.
You're right. Please support your public radio.
Oh, who could say no to that, ladies and gentlemen? 410-235-1395. Call right away. You've heard it from on high.
And if anyone wants to learn more about dialects, we're doing it on Saturday the 19th at the Everyman Theater, Irish Dialect.
Irish Dialect, Saturday the 19th at the Everyman. All right, Gary Logan, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Logan is the resident dialects coach at the Everyman Theater. Their production of Outside Mullingar opens in previews tonight and runs through January 10th. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning.